Lecture 33, Language Death, The Problem.
This series has been about a process of growth, of mixture, of rebirth, and even extravagance. Languages go further than they should, but they just do it, and they come out bruised, sadder, and wiser. But there's another part of the history of language, and that is decline and extinction. This is just as with flora and fauna. There is a serious crisis in terms of how many species are being exterminated in the world today. And for related reasons, there is what many would consider a crisis in terms of how many languages are ceasing to be spoken. And what it comes down to is that as soon as a generation of speakers are not using an indigenous language, and they're not passing that language on to the next generation, i.e. their children, then the language is on its way to disappearing completely. And it's important to realize that all it takes is one generation, because the way a language is passed down is to children. Once you're 12, 13-ish, 14-ish, your abilities to master a language quickly and flawlessly start to decline. And after you're an adult, unless you are some combination of lucky and obsessive, you really cannot acquire a language in anything approaching perfection. So the way that the ability to do what I'm doing now in this particular language is passed on is when you are tiny. Once a society goes through a generation where the language is not being passed on to the tiny, then the language cannot breathe again. So that means that if you meet a society where very old people are speaking the language in great numbers, so people losing their teeth are chattering along in the language in the dozens or the hundreds, but then middle-aged people do not speak the language, then the language is still in trouble, because languages are not usually passed on from people in their 80s to children. The people in their 80s can help, but usually it's the primary caretaker who does this. And so, once a language skips a generation, chances are that it is going to disappear. And what's important with language is that when it disappears, we are not talking about the Ozymandias notion of there being some sort of relic to reconstruct what the past used to be like from. If a language disappears and it hasn't been put into writing, and remember that writing only came along at 11:08 p.m. if language has existed for 24 hours, and remember that most languages in the world, i.e. the vast majority, are not written in any serious way, then once the language is gone, it really is gone. There were once creatures in this world that were much taller and bigger than buildings. We know them as dinosaurs. You can see the skeletons in the museums. And we often reify these skeletons into something different. We think, well, there is a dinosaur skeleton. And there are times when you have to look at those skeletons, which are dwarfing practically the room, and think, that lived. That had skin and muscles. It mated, it made noise, it messed things up, it had emotions, it went to the bathroom. That was a living thing. Now, we can know a whole lot about dinosaurs based on finding those bones, and there's so many massively clever ways that we can reconstruct what these animals were like from extrapolating from the bones. But with a language, it's not like that. If somebody is doing what I'm doing now, but it's a language that is not written and is never used in CD series or DVD series for the teaching company, then it's just gone, as a great many languages throughout human history surely have been. It's just a mouthful of air, and if it's not recorded, there's no way to recover it. If we find an ancient skeleton, we have no way to reconstruct from looking at its hyoid bone and the cut of its jaw and how its teeth were, what language it spoke. So when a language is dead, it is dead. So that's the nature of the crisis. And the fact is that languages have always died to an extent. It's not that this crisis that we have today has no kind of qualitative precedent. Languages have died when all of their speakers were exterminated for some reason. Or more frequently, it's that speakers of a language are subordinated by some group and gradually switch to the language of the dominant. So we've seen that in Indo-European, the totality of Indo-European has included a great many languages that are now dead, such as Hittite in Turkey and Tocharian, the language connected with the Caucasian mummies in China that we talked about. Those are dead languages, and I don't think that generally there's an organ chord of sorrow when we think about Hittite. Oh, what a tragedy that nobody speaks Hittite. We think, well, nobody does. We never knew anybody who did, and it's nice to have some scholars studying Hittite, but we have other languages we can speak. So it did happen. And even in the Eurasian language, even in the Eurasian region alone, there are dozens of languages that we know have died, some of them recorded, a great many of them not at all, or in just, say, a word list or two, or an inscription that says something like, "This is my sheep," but that doesn't give you a sense of what the whole language was like. So it's common. And the process accelerated with the Neolithic Revolution. As I've said before, it used to be that human beings were small hunter-gatherer groups patching the globe, only knowing each other when they happened to be close to each other. But once we had certain groups spreading and taking over large portions of land and in the process subjugating other people, then you had a situation where certainly a great many languages were being exterminated. So there are estimates that there were probably tens of thousands of languages at a time in this original hunter-gatherer situation, and yet today we've got 6,000. Now, if you look at the countries of the world and think that there must be 200 or 300 languages, then when I say 6,000, that seems like a lot. But of course, 6,000 is just a fraction of what could have been 50,000 or 100,000. So, in general, migrators' languages tend to extinguish the languages of the people that they encounter. And there are probably fewer languages today than at any other point in human history since humans had migrated extensively enough to more or less cover the planet. But the process today is occurring at a much more accelerated rate. And an interesting statistic is that today, 96% of the world's people speak one of the 20 most spoken languages. Now, in the vast majority of cases, they also speak one of the many other languages, but they also are speaking one of the big 20. The big 20 are Chinese, English, Spanish, Hindi, Arabic, Bengali, Russian, Portuguese, Japanese, German, French, Punjabi, Javanese, believe it or not, Bihari, you probably won't believe that because you probably haven't heard of it, most people haven't, Italian, Korean, Telugu, Tamil, Marathi, and, interesting, Vietnamese is one of them. So those are the big 20, and pretty much everybody on Earth speaks one of those, which is dangerous in terms of the others because as life and reality tend to have it, if you're speaking one of the big ones, there's quite a chance that a generation that you sire, or a generation that that generation sires, is going to switch to only that one. And that's especially the case the smaller your indigenous language is. And so, according to one estimate, we will only have 10% of the languages that we have today in the year 2100. And so in roughly a century, we will lose about 5,500 languages as spoken ones. And that is sobering. It's also been said that a language on Earth dies somewhere every 2 weeks. And so we're speaking English and it keeps going, but imagine if this just vanished, if there was a 215-year-old woman and she was the last speaker of English and it had never been written down except for one shard of the Bible and something scratched on the back of a Bazooka Joe wrapper, which of course is redundant because the Bazooka Joe wrapper would be in English, but you take my point. And then she dies her last breath and her last word is something like Bosco, and then that's it. That is happening to one language every 2 weeks. And so, it's important to remember that we're talking about a great diversity here. So for every relatively big language you know of, you should imagine that there are a whole bunch of languages rather like that that you would have no reason to have ever heard of. So there is Vietnamese, but then we talked about that language Trào. Trào is one of a bunch of languages with names like Palawang and Hre and Bahnar that no one has any reason to know unless you happen to be in those places. Or there's Zulu, and there's Xhosa, or Xhosa. And those are Bantu languages that we hear a lot about because of South Africa, because of Nelson Mandela, because of Miriam Makeba. But then there are a whole bunch of other Bantu languages like Sotho and Ikalanga and all sorts of languages with names that sound kind of like that, where chances are we're never going to hear much about them here. Persian in Iran is a variation on a theme, and then there are a whole bunch of other languages like Farazandi and Zaza, and languages whose names tend to sound kind of like a veil on a woman or something like that. And they're spoken by small groups. We'll never meet any of them. Lately, we hear more than I ever thought we would about one of that gang, that is Pashto, and that's because of our adventures in Afghanistan. But before this Afghanistan adventure began, I think most of us probably had never heard of Pashto, nor do most of us have any reason to know much about it. So there are many, many, many languages in the world. So the extent of what we're seeing is such that, as I have mentioned, there used to be about 300 Native American languages spoken in the continental United States. Four centuries ago, it was about 300. Today, a third of those languages are spoken by no one. Some of them were tabulated as grammars and their dictionaries. Some of them, there's only a word list taken down by somebody half drunk sitting in a glade who didn't like Indians or something like that. And that's all that we've got. Then, of the remaining two-thirds of them, only a handful are being passed down to new generations. And beyond that handful, the languages are generally spoken by very old people. And by old, I don't mean hale and hearty at 72 with a bit of arthritis, but I mean people who are 92, 93, and unlikely to be with us much longer, and even less likely to want to concentrate on teaching a child an extremely complicated language. And so that means that those languages will be dead soon. Australia was home to just about as many languages, and very few of those languages are being passed on to children. There was a language of Tasmania, which was completely exterminated and left behind only occasional fragments. We will never know exactly what happened in terms of that Tasmanian language, because nobody recorded it before it was extinct. I had an interesting experience recently. I was looking at various traits of languages in Indonesia. And Indonesia has all of these islands. And you might guess that in Indonesia, that these islands would be home to languages. And in fact, most of the islands are home to several languages. I was trying to make some general statements about some of the languages in some of these places and found that most of them have not been described in any full way, and that a lot of them are endangered. So, for example, there's an island, Sulawesi, which is shaped vaguely like somebody dancing, if you have a kind of sick imagination. It used to be called Celebes. You might be familiar with Sulawesi from the fact that there's a coffee that Starbucks often sells, which is Sulawesi. It's that. Sulawesi is jam-packed with languages, and fascinating ones, too. Only a handful of those have been described in any serious way. Otherwise, they're word lists. And what kind of description of a language are we talking about when what we know about it is how to say take, son, boy, ball, hello, goodbye, dying language, etc.? That's not the language. We don't know the grammar. So the usual situation there is that. And languages like Indonesian, or in some cases Portuguese, or in some cases a Creole of this or a Creole of that, are threatening a lot of these indigenous languages, and some of them are clearly going to disappear without ever having been recorded in any real way. So what happens to a language when it's dying is a question. Can you see signs of it when it's happening? And the answer is yes. What happens when a language starts to die is that it starts to revert through the pigeon stage down into dust. So instead of seeing a language be at a pigeon stage and build up into a full language, it ends up devolving and passing on its way down that pigeon stage and then becoming just a splat on the floor. What happens is that when the language stops being used regularly, it starts being spoken in a way that shaves off the fascinating machinery that defines human language. So it starts to revert to this pigeon-like stage. So, for example, the Cayuga language, that's one of the grand 300 Native American languages, its vocabulary started to shrink. By the 1980s, it was spoken mostly by very old people. And it had a word for leg, it had a word for foot, and it had a word for eye. But it didn't have a word for thigh, it didn't have a word for ankle, it didn't have a word for cheek. So it had the basics. You know, you can't talk if you can't say something about your leg hurting. But, you know, you don't necessarily need thigh, you can just point to it. So a language is kind of luxurious to have a word for thigh. No thigh, no ankle, no cheek. The original word for enter was no longer used, they were just using go. That's nice. So you do go into a room. You could also enter the room. That's a nice little detail, nice nuance, a nice antimacassar on the chair. But that's gone. So in other words, it's getting more and more like Rusinorsk and less like a real language, such as Cayuga the way it was before. Or take suffixes. Hablo, hablas, habla, hablamos, hablais, hablan. That is the bugbear of the learner. It's also the bugbear of the person who is losing their language. So in Spanish, if you want to say that you will speak, you might want to say, voy a hablar, I'm going to speak. Because that's a little easier than remembering that little ending and saying, I will speak, hablaré. That's kind of a laziness that we're all probably familiar with to some extent if we've tried to master an inflectional language. Dying language speakers, i.e. speakers of a dying language, not people who are in the process of expiring, tend to avoid prefixes and suffixes of that kind because the separate words tend to be easier to remember. So there's a language in Central America called Pipil, and there's a future marker, which is a suffix, S. It's an ending, S. But today, speakers tend to use the go verb and say, I'm going to speak, instead of bothering with tacking on that S and dealing with the complications that come from how it sometimes changes and things like that. So the complicated parts start to flake away. Then there's just the whole notion of articulateness. There are levels of language. There are ways of using it well. And it's not only based on big fancy words. It's based on just how smartly you can express yourself, how deftly. Many Native American languages, as we've seen, what we think of as a sentence is a single word. And this varies even within the language how much you do that. And where you do that and when is part of speaking the language with nuance. You have to really speak the language to know when to come up with one of those word sentences and when to actually express with separate words. And so, for example, in Cayuga, one way to say she has a big house is to use this one big word pronounced roughly konotsoane. And what that means is it big houses her. Like, it's bothering me. A Pennsylvania Dutch person might say it wonders me instead of I wonder or it's marvelous. And to say she has a big house, you say that the state of having a big house is put upon her. And so it big houses her. That's how you say it. Now that to us sounds like some sort of mental twist. But in Cayuga, that is quite normal. But big surprise, in Cayuga today, speakers of the dying version say she has a big house, or they say her house is big. That's how you would actually render it word for word. They don't have the konosawane. That nuance is lost, so it's becoming a more elementary language. So the generation after the one that speaks the language on this level, where it is the language, but it's not the language as it used to be, it's the old gray mare, the generation after that will speak a few words, and they might have some phrases, but if what you're being exposed to is this, for one thing, your parents or the people who are raising you probably aren't speaking it all the time. Chances are somebody doesn't speak something all the time that they can't really express themselves in. Chances are that person is speaking English most of the time or some other language. So you're not going to hear it that much. And even if you did, you're getting this kind of weak signal. And so your signal is going to be even weaker still. So if you're listening to that kind of Cayuga, and it's something that you're hearing very occasionally, then you are not going to speak Cayuga at all. And then certainly when you have a child, many years after you not learned Cayuga, you're not going to pass on any Cayuga words to that child. That child will be lucky to have two words of Cayuga. And that's, of course, not a language at all. Now, this is something that is often exemplified through looking at what we might think of as exotic languages like Cayuga, but we can actually see analogs to this happening all the time in our immediate lives. You can scratch the surface of the way many immigrants' children speak the language of their parents, and you can see that actually they're not speaking the language the way their parents did. And on the folk level, often it's thought that it's that they don't know as many words. But that's really only the beginning. It's the structure that's melting away quite naturally because these kids are speaking English all the time. And so, a very good example of this is I had a girlfriend about 4,000 years ago, and she had been born in Germany. And she had come to the United States at 6. Her German was still fluent. She had a grandmother who would come every summer, or she would go visit the grandmother every summer. The grandmother spoke not a lick of English, and she had a full relationship with the grandmother. And she had often spent time in Germany. She had been a waitress in Germany for the summer. And so she spoke fluent German. No doubt about that. Where she and her brother visited once, and they would speak German when they didn't want anybody to understand what they were saying. For some reason, with the brother, that included saying, "So where are we going?" I never quite understood why that was a secret sentence, but that was what they did. So, she spoke German, but it was around that time that, because I'm clinically insane, I decided that I needed to know German for no particular reason. And I taught myself at that point well enough to participate in this where are we going business and to understand it if it was spoon-fed to me. And I could read it. But really, when you're dealing with knowing a language, it's dealing with it in real life. And what was interesting about this woman's German was that once I got to a certain point, I realized that although she certainly spoke the language, she didn't speak it the way a native German would, and it wasn't just that she probably didn't know the word for your fourth toe on your left foot. For one thing, all of us are familiar with how you can have a great book knowledge of a language, then you go to the country and you have this feeling that people are talking too fast. Well, it's not that there are any people who for some reason talk too fast. We English speakers talk pretty quickly too, but it's just that you're not used to the subtleties of the accent and the sound system. Spend a couple of weeks or, you know, a month at the longest, and you start finding that you actually start to understand what people are saying more because you've got this American accent out of your head that you're expecting everything to be said in. So I noticed that when I traveled to Germany with this woman that I had a hard time understanding what German people were saying. If they had all just written it down, I would have gotten it. But having it fired at me live, you know, while I was jet-lagged, you know, it's always about potatoes or going to the bathroom, I had a hard time understanding what was being said. I could always understand everything that the woman said, and we were in various social settings, and it was interesting. They were all speaking German, but for some reason hers to me was as clear as a bell. The reason was because she spoke German with an American accent, so she was rendering the language in a way that I was familiar with. Everybody else was speaking it with a true German accent. Now, she wasn't speaking it with a horrible German accent. It wasn't "Ich bin ein Berliner," but it was enough that I had no trouble understanding her. And then there were other things. I started to notice that if she was presented with a passage of adult German using sophisticated sentence structure, and not the word for the fourth toe on the left foot, but words along the lines of association, words along the lines of mir, the sorts of things that you don't expect a three-year-old to use. Three-year-olds don't talk about mir association, nor do six-year-olds. I noticed that she was kind of weak in that realm, which is what you would expect if your actual use of the language stopped when you were six, and from then on you had a casual relationship with relatives once a year, but you had no reason to grow into a more adult version of the language. So she spoke fluent German, and that was wonderful, but it was also a slightly atrophied German. It was what a linguist would call immigrant German. And more to the point, if she married someone who spoke German exactly that way, and they were in the United States, unless they made a really superhuman effort, chances are they would speak English quite a bit around that kid, and the kid would hear English the minute the kid started leaving the house for any length of time. And in the meantime, what the kid would get is mostly English, some German, but a German that's actually kind of fragmentary, and the kid would reproduce an even lesser German, and so on. So we're seeing that in this country with Chinese. We're seeing it in this country with Russian. Russian is a massively complex language. Depending on when the Russian immigrant child comes over, their Russian is full of not just variations, and I've emphasized in this course that what we often think of as mistakes are just variations, but there are mistakes. Like on one of these sets, we had to change when I confused bought and brought. It is a problem that I have in my brain. My mother used to get on me about it when I was three. To me, bought and brought are the same. I know intellectually. I'd never make the mistake in writing. But if I'm speaking casually, to me, I brought it at the store for 3 cents. Sounds great. I bought the chair over to my mother and put it down. Sounds great. That is my sickness. That is not variation. That is a mistake. It's something that I should be corrected out of. In the same way, we would be finding in kids like this girlfriend's and her husband's mistakes, a German with things that really weren't right, in the same way as in many immigrant Russians' kids, what they're making are mistakes in Russian, and these things just kind of continue. So, it is a situation where a language really just gives up the ghost. That's what goes on. But there is an issue that we might want to consider, which is exactly why we should care about this. It's this guilty kind of question that some of us might have. Because, of course, the PC version of this is that diversity is disappearing and we must have diversity. But if we kind of think beyond that, we might want to ask in our spare time, in this particular case, is the diversity really so wonderful? So, for example, the story of the Tower of Babel is generally considered something of a tragedy. It was a dirty trick played, the idea being to keep people from understanding each other. Would it be so terrible if everybody spoke one language? And, of course, some of us find foreign languages neat, and I'm one of them. So I think, well, that'd be kind of boring if you got off the plane and people were talking like this. But, you know, people have different interests. I don't care about football. Most people seem to. So I can't take that as evidence of policy that I would like there to be lots of languages. For many people, I think it'd be perfectly fine if everybody spoke English when you got off of the plane, because you wouldn't have these communication problems. The UN wouldn't have to spend all this money. We wouldn't have to waste time in all of these courses teaching languages badly anyway. We wouldn't misinterpret people because of their accents and their mistakes. It's an effort to learn to see the full human being underneath mistakes in a language you're used to hearing spoken properly. I wouldn't have gone to Russia and asked for apricots and been given a cup of coffee. None of that would have happened if we really just had one language. Suppose it wasn't English. Suppose the language was Chow. Still, just one language. And so, we have to realize that the situation we have now is really just kind of an accident. The truth is that we have so many languages not because we are hardwired in our brains or because of natural selection for diversity or anything like that. I've also heard it said that it's advantageous that we have different languages because then groups can differ themselves from each other and then better be positioned to trust one another and form bonds with one another and thrive through the benefits of cooperation. Hogwash. The reason that we have all these different languages is because once people speaking the first language were in separate places, what our mouths and our brains tend to do to a language gradually over time was different in each place. And that is why you have English and Japanese. And that's a rather faceless process. And so language changes like a game of operator, and you start out whispering in someone's ear. Frogs are sometimes ugly, And then after you go like 9 times down the line, what comes out is something like, I was not involved with that woman, or something like that. That is how language change works. But the fact is, we might say that we want to care about losing all these languages for the simple reason that languages, as I hope we've seen in this series, are really, really interesting. And if all there was English, then I wouldn't have been able to talk about things like evidential markers and clicks. So there is that part. There's also an argument that many would make that language is tied to cultures. And as I've said, I think that that argument tends to be exaggerated, but it's not completely wrong. When a language dies, chances are that a culture has died with it. Languages can also tell us a great deal about the human mind. And in terms of what language can tell us about the mind, we do need to see all of the different kinds of languages. And each one that dies may deprive us of a chance to find, as it were, that medicinal plant with some sort of valuable property, or something that will tell us something more general about all of the plants, i.e. all of languages and all of minds. So it's a complex issue, and as such, we're going to continue it in the next lecture.